Today on the 21st Show, the campaign to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois after Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election. We'll have the 13th in our series of interviews with Democrat Steve Botsford. He was a walk-on football player at Notre Dame, spent a couple years on the staff of a congressman in Washington, and now works with his family's businesses, a real estate holding firm and a biotech company working on cancer treatment. We want to put your questions to Botsford, so you can call in throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. Once again, the number is 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we continue our conversations with people seeking their party nomination for U.S. Senate from Illinois. This is for the vacancy being created by Dick Durbin's decision not to seek a sixth term. As a reminder, early voting is now underway across the 21st state. Primary day is March 17th. I should say this is the last interview we currently have scheduled. I want to list the candidates we've already spoken with briefly. You can find these conversations on our website, 21stshow.org. On the Democratic side, in alphabetical order, that includes Sean Brown, Owisi Bustos, Jonathan Dean, Robin Kelly, Brian Maxwell, Kevin Ryan, and Juliana Stratton. On the Republican side, we've heard from R. Kerry Caparelli, Casey Hilbeck, Jeannie Evans, Pamela Denise Long, and Don Tracy. Again, all those conversations are linked right at the top of 21stshow.org. As for the remaining candidates, Democratic frontrunner Raja Krishnamurti's campaign has expressed interest, but canceled on us twice late last year, has not rescheduled. Fellow Democratic candidate Christopher Swan was unable to make our scheduled interview earlier this month, citing a family emergency. And Republican Jimmy Lee Tillman II has not responded to our inquiries. Our DMs are still open, as they say. In the meantime, if you want to listen to any of those conversations, again, you can find them at our website, 21stshow.org. Back to today. My guest is Steve Botsford. He works with his family's real estate and biotech firms. He's worked in the world of finance and also spent some time on the world of politics as a legislative assistant for a former California member of the U.S. House of Representatives, a Democrat. He also worked on the 2018 Attorney General campaign of Erica Harold, a Republican. Botsford grew up in Chicago's northwest suburbs. He studied for a time at Indiana University, then went on to Notre Dame, where he was a walk-on with the football team. He was graduated from there with a degree in economics. After that work as a legislative aide, he went back to school, got a master's in applied economics from Georgetown, then working in finance, got a master's in business administration from Northwestern University. He previously ran for the Chicago City Council in 2023, unsuccessfully, and is now seeking the Democratic nomination for Senate. Botsford was set to join us live in our studios in Urbana today, but apparently there was a scheduling mishap, so he's joining us remotely instead. Steve Botsford, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can join us today throughout the hour. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right, Steve, tell me about growing up in the Chicago suburbs. What was your upbringing like?
So I grew up in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. Had a pretty great upbringing. I have two sisters, one of which is older, 2 years older, than one is 4 years younger. Grew up pretty normal. Wasn't really doing too much other than going to school and having fun with friends. Grew up with my number one dream was to play football at Notre Dame. So, you know, a lot of kids want to be a astronaut or a firefighter, or some crazy kids want to be president for some reason. But when you asked me what I wanted to do, I said I wanted to play football at Notre Dame. So that was kind of my North Star growing up. And so I went to St. Vider High School in Arlington Heights, played football, but wasn't a starter. So it didn't look so good that I was going to be able to make that dream happen. And then I didn't get into Notre Dame for undergrad. So I didn't get in. Got rejected. My grades weren't good enough. Got into a few schools, ended up going to Indiana University, which is where my older sister was going at the time, had a good business school. But I went there with the number one goal was going to be I was going to get really good grades. I was going to dedicate myself a little more to the classroom than I had previously, get good grades, and then transfer to Notre Dame. So I was there for 1 year, got the grades I had hoped for, actually learned how to study instead of just reading the chapter one night before the test, actually prepared and took notes and actually did all the things you need to do if you want to get good grades.
That's what I was missing in college. Okay.
Sorry,
little
say
joke.
Again.
I just said that's what I was missing in college. Little joke.
Exactly. That's what I was missing all through high school. So I feel you. And then I was able to transfer. And so I got there in the fall of my sophomore year. Had one semester as just a full-time student. And then the tryouts were the second semester, and I got an opportunity to walk on. And was able to make the team and spent 2 years on the football team, living the absolute dream. So yeah, growing up it was a good time. A lot of great friends, still friends with a lot of my high school friends, and some even friends before high school. And then was able to go to Notre Dame and kind of, you know, achieve that childhood dream at a young age.
So I mentioned you had worked as a legislative assistant. What, why did you want to get into politics?
So it's funny, obviously, you know, in politics now, and so many people try to make a story about how they were never interested, and I really wasn't. So I grew up, like I said, my number one goal was football. And so then you get to college. I was originally a major, when I was at IU, I was a major in business finance, but you couldn't transfer into Notre Dame's business school back then. So I had to change to another major if I wanted to go to Notre Dame. And I looked around, like, okay, what majors can I take? And economics was the closest thing to business. So I took economics, really fell in love with economics. I was like, okay, it was the first time in my life that like a class just made complete sense. And like, I was good at it. I was always pretty decent at school in high school and growing up, but that was like the first time everything just clicked and I actually enjoyed reading and learning. And so I was doing that, and I was coming out of, I was getting ready to graduate, and I had a couple of job offers. I graduated in 2011. So it's still kind of not the height of the recession, but still not a great time to come out of university. So I had a few job offers, none of which were spectacular. And I was going to go take the best job offer was, and when I say best, it was just the one that was going to pay me the most because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wanted to work in business. It was one of the big credit card companies, and it was based out of Dallas, and it was a nice salary. I had a signing bonus, which I thought was cool. And so I was telling my dad, like, this is where I'm going to work here. And I'm like, this is what I'm doing. I'm in Dallas. Like, Dallas is a cool city. I've never been there. And he's like, all right, so like, what are you going to be doing? I'm like, oh, I'm working for this credit card company. And he's like, so you really want to spend your career just trying to reconfigure your credit card terms to make people that don't need debt take on more debt than they actually really need? I was like, well, Dad, when you put it that way, that job does sound like kind of sucks, doesn't it? He's like, yeah, it doesn't really seem like it's like, you know, something that like your moral calling. And he goes, you know, we've got he was a self-employed entrepreneur in real estate. He's like, hey, I've got a big real estate deal coming up. It'll take us about a year and a half. I think, you know, if you want, you can come work with me. I'll teach you real estate, and then you can go on and do something else. But I think in the next year and a half, there's going to be enough learning opportunities that it makes sense to come work for me. So I, you know, thought about it, and I was like, all right, that makes more sense. Rather than getting people into credit card debt, I'll come do a real estate deal. And so I was working with my dad, enjoying it, learning. I mean, I was just, you know, it's your dad, so you're riding shotgun. I'm 22 years old. I'm in a bunch of meetings that are way over my head, you know, seniority-wise. And, you know, I get to write down all these questions, and every time we walk out of a meeting, I've got a list of things. I'm like, hey, Dad, why did we do this? Why did you say that? What does this mean? And so I'm just learning so much, which is great. And I was planning on going back to law. I was planning on going to law school. And so my dad went to law school. He used his law degree as a avenue to make his business more successful. And so that's what, you know, obviously a lot of people like to be like their father. That's what my aim was. I'm like, hey, he's successful in business. He has a law degree. I'll go get a law degree and then try to be successful in business. So we were finishing up this project, and it was going to be done, you know, good or bad. It was going to be done January 1. And so I was going to go to law school the following fall. So I'd had about, you know, a 7 to 8 month span that I was going to have to do something. And my dad was like, you know, you're too young to have that big of a gap on your resume. So figure out some type of, you know, short-term gig you can do that you think will help you in the future. I'm like, okay, I was thinking about it. And so our real estate project was in the San Fernando Valley in just north downtown Los Angeles. And there was a city councilman that was that we had my dad had previously rezoned the property, so he had gone through the city council office. So he'd become, friendly with him, and he's continued to be friends with him after the city council or after the rezoning. And so we would meet with him on all the issues we were doing. We were trying to do some more development and purchasing of the site. And he was at the time running, his name was Tony Cardenas, and he was running for Congress. And so he, if he was going to win, he was going to, win in November. He'd take office in January. I was talked to my dad and I said, "Hey, what do you think about just me seeing if I could go intern for, like at the time, Councilman Cardenas? I mean, that would be a good 8 months, 9 months. Work on Capitol Hill. See how laws are made before you go and learn the law. That seems like a pretty good way to spend 8 to 9 months." And he's like, "Yeah, I think so. It's a smart idea. So let's talk to him. Let's talk to him next time we see him." So next time we were in L.A. We were having coffee or breakfast or something, and we brought it up. He's like, "Steve, you really want to come work for me in D.C.? Like, sir, if you're willing to have me, I would love to." And he's like, "All right, great." He's like, "I don't." He's like, "I haven't won the race yet. I haven't hired staff, but I don't know what you'll be doing, but you're in." I was like, "Okay, cool." So he ends up winning his race, and so he starts to build the staff, and so he hires one of his top people in the city council office was the only person that was going to come to D.C. with him. And so he just told him, "Hey, there's this guy I know. He's like young. He's hardworking. I told him he can. He had a spot. So interview him, figure out what he can do, and see if something works." And so something somehow got lost in translation between me talking to the councilman and the councilman talking to his staffer. But he ended up hiring me full time as his legislative correspondent, which is like, if you're a congressional staff, that's like about two or three rings up a ladder. Normally, you had to be there for about 12 to 18 months before you get an opportunity like that. So I got, they told me that, and I'm like, "Wow, this is pretty cool. I will." I was talking about, I'm like, "I think I'm going to push off law school. I mean, I think this is a better opportunity. I think I'm going to learn more here." And so I decided to push off law school, and I was going to stay there for a couple of years. And it was just an awesome experience. I mean, I
Yeah, let
think.
me ask you, what did you learn about the way U.S. government works that maybe you didn't know before, that, were there any sort of eye-opening experiences for you in that setting?
Yeah, I mean, it was the whole thing was eye-opening, especially for me. Obviously, most of the people I worked with, they were all poli-sci majors. So that's what they studied, and I was just economics. And I wasn't interested in politics. And so I came in with like I was like just an empty slate. And so it was just drinking out of a fire hose all the time, which was super exciting. I my mind. A little ADHD, so my mind's always everywhere. So being able to do a million different things during a day is really, really good for me. And learned so much. Learned it was so fast paced, which I loved. And like the thing I loved was it was like it developed a real understanding of like how you can like use public policy to really help people at scale. In the I'm a millennial. A lot of us millennials always have the mantra like I want to make the world a better place, and it seemed like actually working in public policy was a great place to do that. So that's kind of where I developed a passion for it, and I could take my economics background and how I see the world as an economist and apply to so many different policy positions across the board. So, and the other awesome part was so our staff was about 8 to 10, maybe 11 people, and Washington D.C. is a huge good public transportation town, so everyone took the metro in. And I'm from the suburbs of Chicago, so I never really took like public transportation all the time. I was always just, "Hey, you get in the car, you drive." And so I brought my car out. So I was the only staffer on, I was the only person on staff that had a car. So whenever the congressman needed to go to an offsite meeting, he would just say, "Stevie, can you drive me?" And I'd be like, "Of course, one, you're my boss, and two, where you're going is probably cooler than what I'm doing." And so he would I would drive him to an event or a meeting or whatnot, and most of the time he'd say, "All right, park the car and like come on in." And so I'm sitting here again. I'm 23, 24, and again in meetings way above my pay grade. And I just got to sit there and listen. It was just so cool. And so I would like have like a real shotgun like view of. And he was the cool part was like he was a freshman member too, so he's getting all the stuff where like you're just coming in like and you're getting introduced to it. And I just got to sit there right next to him for so much of it. So I really did get to see how like how cool it was, how much you could actually get done. And then you get to see the dysfunction as well. You see how much of Congress is all run by leadership. It's so little is done through committee. So much is like, if the leadership doesn't want a bill passed or doesn't want a bill talked about, it just doesn't happen. So you see what's broken. The days of like young members going there and getting a real opportunity to change things are so far past. It's so leadership driven. And that's why we get, you know, these two super polarized parties, because they're led by the leadership, which is also polarized, and you don't get nearly as much working together as you would hope so.
All right. Well, we have about 90 seconds until we need to take a break, and we're on a fixed clock, so I'll hold you to that.
Yep.
So briefly, okay, to sort of set up the rest of our conversation, why do you want to be a U.S. Senator now?
Because I think politics is as broken as it's ever been in my lifetime, and I think that we need to start doing things different. If we keep sending the same establishment politicians that have made a career of it, have done everything, you know, up the ladder the normal way and have worked their way through all the party politics, we're going to keep getting these same results. And I don't think we can have another 5, 6, 10, 15 years of the current path and still be a healthy democracy, and like a democracy where we're actually all together, as opposed to like the hate you see on both sides towards each other. And so it's one of those that I see a broken system. I think I can help fix it. And, you know, if not me, then who?
All right. We are talking with Steve Botsford, one of the candidates in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senator from Illinois. Again, early voting is open now ahead of Election Day, which is March 17th. If you want to hear the interviews we've done with other candidates in this race, Democratic and Republican, you can find them at our website, which is 21stshow.org. When we come back, we're going to be talking about domestic policy, foreign policy, and Senate procedure and other things that Steve Botsford, if he were to win the primary and the general election this fall, would have to be dealing with as a United States Senator. If you have questions, if you want to join us today, our phone lines are open. The number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We will have more with Steve Botsford after a short break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today with Steve Botsford, one of the candidates in the Democratic primary for United States Senator from Illinois, of course, to fill the vacancy being created by Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election at the this year, I should say. He will be stepping down in January when his term ends. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. All right. One of the top domestic policy concerns that has been on our minds this year is immigration enforcement. Of course, Chicago had its very close-up experience of it late last year. Minneapolis has been going through it now. A couple of American citizens have been shot by federal agents, Alex Preddy, Renee Good. How have you been thinking about the actions of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Administration and the Border Patrol in Minneapolis and Chicago?
Yeah, so obviously we saw this disaster a little bit before Minnesota got it. They came here first, and we saw it, just people on the street, the ICE agents going to child care facilities, going to Home Depots, helicoptering out from, you know, jumping down from helicopters, just an absolute complete abuse of power from the Trump administration. So back when we were having our first government shutdown, I was thinking like the Senate Democrats were going to go for health care. And I'm just a candidate. So I tweet and I put out statements. I don't really have much power, but my thing was, we should also include ICE reform. We need to have more things to be at the table if we're going to keep funding this government. And we couldn't just get a promise for a health care vote to be the only thing we were going to get to open it. So my big five, with ICE reform, that I don't think we should fund any government programs willingly until we get at least a couple of them. First off, it's got to be no more masks, no more hidden badges. We need the ICE to have warrants signed by judges. We also need to make sure that ICE is only going after criminals and not just, like I said, showing up at childcare facilities or Home Depots and just picking people up and, you know, seeing whether or not they have documentation. We also need independent investigations into the use of force. Obviously, I do not trust the administration to investigate the deaths of Ms. Good and Mr. Peretti. And lastly, I think this would actually go a way to solve a lot of them is if we really hold the line and try to force Trump to fire Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller, his top aide, the chief architect of this anti-immigrant policy. What do you think about, you know, this phrase abolish ICE was once a fringe position? There have been polls showing more people are supporting it. Where are you on that? Should we abolish ICE?
So obviously we haven't always had ICE. We've had border security before the Department of Homeland Security even existed. That was created after 9/11. So there are other ways that we could secure our border. I don't necessarily love anytime we get into slogans. I don't think that we should govern on slogans and shibboleths. I think I'd rather policy because I think so often an idea of abolishing ICE can be misconstrued as no enforcement whatsoever. And we obviously have to enforce our borders. When there are illegal immigrants that are criminals, we need to get them out of the country. So we need to have enforcement. I don't think ICE is doing a good job at all. I think that we take everybody that's like been hired. So,
exactly the point I wanted to get at is, you know, even if you don't, so if let's say you don't abolish it and replace it with something else, what do you do with all these people who are being recruited with, you know, apparently white nationalist songs and coded messages and things like that, who are being encouraged to join this agency now, who are going to be federal employees for
exactly. No. Yeah. So when Kristi Noem came in, they ran a recruiting campaign called Defend the Homeland. And they ran commercials on, you know, NFL games and just normal TV. And they were horrified. I mean, it was the rhetoric they used is just like, okay, this is next level bad. So I think from the day that campaign started, anyone that's been hired since then should be immediately fired. Like, and so we need to clear out who was there and start bringing in, you know, whatever we have. If we need new people, it just needs to be new people that were not did not sign up between the day that campaign started to now. We should also focus more if we're going to start hiring people with a military background or a police background, not just vigilantes off the street that get riled up from a Trump rally and want to jump in on the team. So we definitely need to do a better job hiring, and we need to fire right away. The second we get some power back, we need anybody that was part of this campaign needs to be fired.
This goes to a bigger question and a debate among Democrats, and especially if they're able to retake power in the House and potentially the Senate, as to what the focus should be. Should it be on accountability? Should it be going back and holding investigations and perhaps even impeaching administration officials? Or should it be focused on, you know, the price of eggs, the price of butter, that kind of thing? You know, we need to talk about the future, not the past. Where are you in that sort of debate?
Yeah, so I'm future-oriented. I think that if we're going to try, I think we should have a positive vision for America that we're going to go try to sell voters on, and we should go implement that vision. Obviously, if there's criminal conduct that the administration does, that should be prosecuted. But when super partisan Democrats, so normies, independents, when they think about the Democratic Party, I want them to think about a party that's trying to make their lives better, not a party that's trying to punish Trump. Like, there's going to be some punishment to be dealt out for some criminal activity, but I don't want that to be our brand. I want our brand to be working really hard to make their life better and more affordable.
Okay. Well, on that point, let's talk about the economy. What are some of the things that you think the federal government should be doing to improve the economy, especially for Americans with the least income and no wealth to speak of?
Yeah. So my biggest thing, one of the reasons you asked me earlier why I got into this and I said that I think we need something different for our politics to heal. But secondly, is I've got the economic background, like I mentioned. And so I think I can bring a different perspective of really being hard economics all the way through with my agenda. So my agenda is really focused around affordability. And number one is housing. Housing And Illinois is too expensive across the country, but obviously I care about Illinois. It's just too expensive. And the biggest way that we can fix that is by building more of it. That's, you know, simple supply and demand. If we increase the supply of housing, we're going to bring down the cost. And so we need to make it easier to build where people want to live. We need to, a lot of that's local. I was really excited. Governor Pritzker came out with an absolutely fire is positive, super, super good housing plan.
Fire is positive. Thank you. I'm not that old.
Yeah. No, I just want to make sure. I don't know who I'm talking to. A lot of times I talk too fast. And it's an awesome, I mean, this, if we don't allow anybody in the special interests to water down this Pritzker plan, it is going to change housing and housing affordability in Illinois, maybe more so than any other state in the country. So I cannot be more supportive of that plan. And hopefully,
and just to
we can
be
get...
clear with listeners, this is where he called, I presume you're talking about his statewide zoning law to preempt the authority of local governments to do restrictive zoning.
Yes. Yeah. So that is, yeah, it's going to make all communities be more open to housing from the state level. And it's going to be how we build more where people want to live. So I'm fully supportive of that. That's mostly housing is obviously the state level stuff. So that's, I'm glad Pritzker's doing that. From the federal side, I would like to tie a lot of our transit funding to the communities that actually build units. So communities that build more units, they get more transit funding. So that's number one on my affordability is housing. Healthcare, I think that is clearly to the American people, the number two cost driver in their budget. And for that, obviously, I want to restore some of the Obamacare subsidies that Trump took away. But we really got to start tackling the long term, like the real structures of why everything is so expensive. So for me, it's like expanding access, expanding supply. So I want to raise the cap on the residencies so we can have more doctors. There's currently a cap of how many residency slots there are, and that limits how many doctors we get. We also need to start breaking up hospital monopolies. A lot of communities, you may think you have two hospitals in town, but realistically, those two hospitals are either owned by the same company or same private equity group. And then they can collude together and make sure that prices aren't transparent and they don't try to compete for pricing. So while you may have two different names of hospitals, you're really paying the same price and they don't try to make anything cheaper. Also, pharmacy benefit managers end up just being a middleman between you and getting the pharmacy drugs that you need. And a lot of times they're actually owned by the health insurance companies. So a lot of health insurance companies, when you try to enact any changes, they make the argument, we are not that profitable. We're making 7% profits. We're making 4% profits. If you beat us up anymore, then we're going to go under. And that's technically true the way they do their accounting, but those same health insurance companies also own pharmacy benefit managers that are wildly profitable. They're just owned under a different umbrella. So change, getting some real pharmacy benefit manager reform is going to be huge.
What about guaranteed universal health care, Medicare for all?
Yeah, so a lot of people are supportive of Medicare for all, especially I think everybody but me and Raja are not supportive of it in this race. I just don't think that we can afford it. Right now, the U.S. is in $36 trillion plus of debt. Within the next 10 years, the service, just paying the interest on our debt is going to be the largest part of our non-discretionary budget, which means everything else that we want to try to, all the other programs we're going to talk about that politicians like to support, like, is all going to be smaller than paying down the debt. That's how bad our debt's got, and interest rates, as they continue to rise, it's going to make our debt more expensive. So I don't think we can take on such a massive new program right now. I think also in the United States, I think one of the cool parts about our democracy is we've got 50 states and we've got this system of federalism, and it allows states to attempt to do different things, and then we see how it works on the state level before we bring it to the national level. So Massachusetts passed a healthcare bill that was very similar to the Affordable Care Act, and so we saw it work in Massachusetts, and so we saw it didn't work. So then we tried to make it on a national level, and we upsized it. There is no state that has tried to pass a Medicare for All style bill, not even a small super liberal state like Vermont, where Bernie Sanders represents. They looked at trying to pass such a program, and they thought it was too cost prohibitive. So if a state like Vermont can't do it, I just don't see how that's even close to possible for a country as big as ours.
Your website also talks about accelerating drug reviews, clinical trials, and more. I presume that would benefit your family's biotech firm in some way. Why are you supportive of those changes?
Yeah, so it really wouldn't. So the biotech firm is really not doing too well. So there's not really a conflict of interest there. That's kind of been a research project that my father's put a lot of time and money into that really hasn't gone anywhere. But so if we're going to want cheaper healthcare, we're going to have to get more innovation. I think we've seen that, you look at COVID and you look how fast we were able to get those mRNA vaccines. That's an amazing innovation that saved countless lives and tons of economic growth because we were able to get back to living our normal lives. And those are the things that we need to be doing, is we need to be investing in the next wave of cures and therapies. And we also, one of the problems, so obviously the Trump administration has been terrible with the NIH. I can't even start how bad they've been with the NIH. But one of the problems with the NIH, this is before Trump, is that so much of the research goes towards older scientists that are already established because it's easier for them to do the grants. And it's also like, for a baseball analogy, they really care about like making sure they can get a single and get on base as opposed to trying to hit home runs. And for most scientists, the largest advances they make, like the biggest discoveries, almost always come in like the first like 25% of their career. But we are just funding, most of our funding goes to people in the last 25% of their career. So I think we need to switch and we need to be more innovation focused and start taking a little more risk in our research investments so that we can get those like next generation absolute home run paradigm shift type innovations that are going to save lives. There's so much we need to fix in medical research, and there's so many cancers and horrible things that people have to go through. And if we start investing more in actually getting cures, that's going to really bring healthcare costs down. And then more importantly, it's going to save lives and more people can get some time with their family.
Just a few more minutes until we need to take another break. I also want to ask you about artificial intelligence, or at least what we are calling artificial intelligence, these large language models and other emerging technologies. Do you think the federal government should take a more active role in regulating the companies doing this work?
Yeah, so I think that the federal government needs to be the one doing the regulating. I think if we let 50 different states make 50 different rules, I think we're going to really slow the innovation we're going to get, and we're going to fall behind our competitors. I think it's important that artificial intelligence is going to be the bedrock, is going to write the rules of the next 10, 20, maybe 100 years of economic growth. And it's going to be the driver of the economy. And I want to make sure that we are in the driver's seat and not China. And so I want to make sure we are as innovative as possible, but there's obviously got to be guardrails. So there's a ton of stuff we had to do around consumer safety. There's a ton of stuff we have to do about deepfakes and making sure that AI algorithmic pricing isn't going absolutely crazy. We need to make sure that we don't end up at 20% unemployment and then, the AI companies just tell everybody, hey, fine, enjoy your universal basic income as we are trillionaires. So there's definitely things that need to be done, and it needs to be done on the federal level. And I want strong safety protections. I want to make sure that our workforce is not decimated. I mean, I think that AI is going to be like the Industrial Revolution, but instead of it happening over a century, it's going to happen over a decade or maybe even less, maybe half a decade. So we need to make sure that the American economy and the American worker is protected in that time of a mass disruption.
All right. We are talking with Steve Botsford, one of the candidates running in the Democratic primary, 10 candidates for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Dick Durbin at the end of his term early next year. Early voting is open now. Primary election day, March 17th. We will continue this conversation after a short break. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email or leave a voicemail or reach us in any other way you want through our website, 21stshow.org. We're going to continue with Steve Botsford, Democrat running in the primary for Senate. After a short break, this is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking with Steve Botsford, candidate in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. We have spoken with now, this is our 13th interview in this series. You can find the others at 21stshow.org. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. All right, in the 15 minutes or so we have remaining, let's talk about some of the other issues you would have to consider as a U.S. senator. What do you think of the president's military buildup around Iran? Would you support or oppose an attack?
Oppose massively, as much as someone can oppose it. I am very dovish when it comes to foreign policy. I do not like the idea of getting us into any foreign wars or foreign entanglements. I think that putting American troops at risk is an absolute last case scenario. And I think entering into the fray with Iran, it's not going to be easy. Obviously, Trump, I was not supportive of him when we bombed the nuclear facilities. I don't think we should be attacking countries, especially without Congress giving the sign off. But this is going to be way harder. That was a one-time thing. This is going to involve us. This is going to get us attacked. This is going to cost American lives, and then we're going to have to retaliate. So I could not be further against this, just in principle. And then the fact that he hasn't come to Congress for authority is just complete lawlessness from the administration.
Another issue that I know is important to a lot of Democratic primary voters. It's been more than 2 years now, 2.5 years almost, since Hamas attacked Israel. Would you say that Israel's response to that in Gaza constituted a genocide?
I wouldn't go and define it as a genocide. I definitely think it was over the top. I definitely think they've committed war crimes at certain points. I think when it comes to this, obviously it's a touchy subject, but it's clear that they've gone way overboard, and we should not be funding this. We should not be giving offensive weapons to Israel. I think we need a two-state solution. And to get there, we're going to need a partner in the Israeli government that is open to a two-state solution. And I don't think the Netanyahu government is that. So I think we should not continue any of this funding as long as Netanyahu is the leader of Israel.
American funding to Israel, you think?
Yes. As long as it's Netanyahu, if we get a new government in Israel that is supportive of a two-state solution, stops the expansion in the West Bank, and is actually going to try to get something with the Palestinians, then we can go back to the relationship we had previously. Obviously, it'll still be different because this has been such a relationship changing event. But yeah, as long as Netanyahu's there, it's got to shut off.
One thing you do hear from people who are supportive of Israel and Israelis themselves is that they don't feel they have a partner on the other side of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Do you think, and yet, a number of countries have recognized a Palestinian state. Do you think America should follow the lead of these other countries that have been recognizing Palestine as its own sovereign entity?
I definitely think that we should be pushing towards that two-state solution and get Palestine to a position that we can recognize them. If you recognize them now while Hamas is running the government, I mean, Hamas is a terrorist group. So I don't think we should be recognizing Hamas as a legitimate leader of a Palestinian state. But once we can get to the point where we have a two-state solution, then yes, of course, that's the goal. That's the goal of a two-state solution.
What about Greenland? Do you think America should seek to conquer Greenland or purchase it, although Denmark has said it's not for sale?
I mean, if it was for sale, we could look at the cost and benefit, but we definitely shouldn't be conquering it. I mean, those are our allies. Greenland is it's actually super strategic important when it comes to defending the U.S. interests, especially against Russia. But we have pretty much all the access to Greenland that we need to defend those interests. So any idea that we're going to make Greenland the 51st state is absolutely asinine. If we're looking into a 51st state, my suggestion is the moon. Yeah, definitely not Greenland.
Another area of foreign policy that has been on our minds recently is Ukraine. Yesterday marked 4 years since Russia's most recent invasion of Ukraine. This has obviously been a cause near and dear to Dick Durbin, whom you would be seeking to succeed in the Senate. Does the United States have an interest in a free Ukraine?
Yes, most definitely. I think we should continue to support Ukraine with the weapons and aid that they need to defend their own country. People have the right to self-determination. And by the same time, I have no interest at all in American troops being on the ground or getting involved. So this is Ukraine's fight. It is Europe's fight. We should fund it from abroad, but we should not be sending U.S. troops any way into harm's way. But yeah, no, Ukraine is its own country, and I believe if Putin wins this war, then there's going to be another one and another one. So I'm glad we're stepping up to support them, and I'm hopeful that the rest of Europe will continue to step up and support them as well.
You know, one of the through lines through this conversation we've been having about foreign affairs is this idea of what is America's place in the world? And something that has been uniting people on the far, far left, I think, and also the far right, or these, you know, supposedly America First group, as they've been styling themselves, is this idea that America's time as a global superpower should be over, right? The post-war world order. And maybe America should either be a regional power or just mind its own affairs at home and try and stay out of the globe as much as possible. Where are you on that? Should America seek to be or remain a global superpower?
Yeah, so America is and has been a force for good. And I believe that the next century should be yet another American century. So I want to stay up and powerful on the world stage. I do not want to engage in some of the foreign interventionism that America has done in the past. I am, like I said, dovish. I don't want to put boots on the ground anywhere, but I want to use our soft power almost everywhere. And I support President Obama's initiative that we should be pulling back out of Europe and the Middle East, let our European allies handle that area, and we should be transitioning to focusing on Asia, and using our relationships in Asia, building up trade ties and allies, so that we can make sure that we're involved and that we're combating the Chinese Communist Party. So we should be a strong, soft power nation. We are the world leader. We should be the world leader. But that being world leader does not mean being the world's policeman.
All right, a few Senate procedure issues I know are going to be on people's minds. We've gotten a question from Sam in Springfield throughout these conversations, who wants to know if you would vote for a new Democratic leader in the Senate to replace Senator Chuck Schumer.
Yes, I would not be voting for Chuck Schumer should I become the next senator. I was originally hoping for Senator Klobuchar, but it looks like she wants to run her great state of Minnesota. So I believe so. I mean, again, I don't get to pick who runs. I get to just say my piece with it. But Senator Van Hollen, I think, would be an absolutely great Senate leader.
What about the filibuster? Would you support eliminating the filibuster?
Yes, I think that the filibuster at one point had a purpose. When it was a abnormal practice that people used to slow down legislation or to make sure the minority had a voice. I think it now is just a roadblock to any legislation, to any progress getting done. I think that us as Democrats, we should be confident in our agenda. I am very confident in the agenda that I put forward on my website, and I put forward in conversations like this, that I want to pass all of it. And I want the American people to decide if it's good for them. And so I'm not worried about what happens if there's overreach, what happens if, you go too far. Like, that's the political party. Like, you should be able to stand up for your agenda and stand up for the results of your agenda and let the American people decide. That's why we have a democracy. And so I think we should completely eliminate the filibuster, yes.
This get back or sort of calls back to that question I asked you earlier about the focus. Should Democrats retake the Congress? What would you think about another move to impeach President Trump? Would you be supportive of that?
It's not something that I want to campaign on. I don't think that is what the American people are going to give us power back to do. I don't like President Trump. I think he's most definitely has probably committed some impeachable crimes. I don't think the votes are there to actually impeach him. I'm very pragmatic. If we don't have the votes, why are we going to waste energy? We only have so much political capital. I want to spend it on making people's lives better. In principle, I think he's probably committed impeachable offenses. Do I think we're going to be able to impeach him and get him out of office? No. So am I going to focus on it? No. I'm going to focus on trying to make people's lives better and trying to develop a reason for the not only, obviously, I hope we win back the House and the Senate in 2026, but we also got to start getting ready for hopefully to having a Democratic president in 2028, and then we can really hit the ground running. So I want to start building out the agenda and start building some coalitions with Republicans. So when we get that president in 2028, we can start enacting reforms real quick and start delivering for the American people.
One of your campaign platforms is lowering the federal voting age to 16. What's the case for that?
So I think we have a problem with how few people vote. I think we have a problem with how few people vote in primaries, particularly. I think that our primary system has all the candidates on both sides running to their extremes. If we have more people voting, I think we're going to get some more centrist, more moderate members. And we're not going to get this politics that divides us so much because we're not just running to the edges. And I think that lowering the age to 16 is going to start building that muscle a little earlier in our citizens. If you're, you know, you're 16 years old, you're in high school, you're still probably living with your parents, and your parents go to vote, they take you with them. Like, you vote, I feel if you have a habit of voting, you're going to continue that habit into your adult life. Whereas, you know, when you're 18, maybe you don't even become, you know, get a presidential election until you're 19, 20, 21. And, you know, now you're in college, there's a ton going on. It's in November, you know. College, you know, it's college. There's parties and studies to do, and so it just may fall through the It may fall through the grades, and I want to develop that muscle early on, so people vote. I mean, ideally, I want to make it easier for as many people to vote. One of the other things in my agenda is I want to start looking at mobile voting. I think with some of the cybersecurity advances we have in today's technology, I think it's a great idea of trying to get more voter participation, and I mean. I love doing more mail-in ballots, automatic registration. Anything we can do to get more people voting, I think we'll have a better democracy because of it.
This may be the last question we have time for, but you were a football player. I'm going to ask you to weigh in on this idea that, you know, young men are in crisis right now and particularly alienated from the Democratic Party. Maybe that's two strands of conversation. So let's take the latter one there. You know, it's documented that young men, including Black and Latino young men, sort of didn't vote for the Democrats in the numbers they have in other elections in recent years. What do you make of that? What are Democrats missing that is not speaking to those voters?
Yeah, I think a lot of times that when people decide who they want to vote for, they're thinking, like, we always think, okay, does this person want to have a beer with a candidate? And more so, I think the thing that I men feel is like, does the candidate want to have a beer with me? Like, do they think that I have value? Do they think I'm adding to it? I think some of the rhetoric across the board has gotten to the point where it turns people off. And you just don't see it. And people don't care. I mean, it's funny you talk about like the male loneliness crisis, and I definitely think it exists. But then you get people mocking it, and it's like, all right, well, like, you know, if someone's hurting, you can argue like, oh, well, you still get paid more than women do. Oh, okay, you have this, and this. But like, if someone says they're hurting, and you start giving them statistics, that's not how you connect with somebody. You got to at least be like, hey, I get it. Like, I get it. This sucks. And you look at just how the economy has changed. And yes, like, we're getting a more equal economy. It is great. And that's what we should be looking for. But it is leaving some people behind. And I'm not saying we have to rechange it and go back to 1970 to make it more beneficial to them, but we should at least be able to accept their disappointment with they are not going to get the future that they thought they were going to have. So I think it's pretty simple, just being more open, not putting blame on people, and we had obviously a ton of blue collar work got crushed between globalization and China coming into the WTO. And you just, again, this is an online conversation, so it doesn't really happen in real life, but people, learn to code. It's like, all right, like someone just told you they lost their job and now you're telling them, oh, you're dumb and you need to go learn something else. So I just don't think there's that empathy, especially when it comes to young males from the Democratic Party. I think that's one of the things we got to change if we're going to try to, one, win back the House, the Senate, and the presidency.
Steve Botsford is one of 10 Democrats seeking the party nomination for U.S. Senate. Thanks for your time. Appreciate you speaking with us.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you so much. This has been great.
That is it for us today. Again, you can find other conversations. We have now spoken with 13 of the 16 Democrats and Republican running for Senate. We have it pinned to the top of our website, 21stshow.org, if you want to check out those other conversations. Coming up tomorrow on the show, candidate forum in the 13th Congressional District among the two Republicans who want to vie for the opportunity to challenge Nikki Budzinski or her challenger in the Democratic primary. In the 13th Congressional District in Central Illinois. That's coming up tomorrow here on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.